G'day everybody, my name's Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
You're listening to the Technical Tennis Podcast, and we're in the middle of, well, not really the middle yet, we're in the early stages of the US Open. Day two with a lot of rain and a lot of matches not played, but we did get some interesting results yesterday. So I want to start out by talking about Sharapova taking down Simone Halep in three sets in the opening round, which was, by the way, step one for Venus Williams to win the tournament, become if for those of you who listened last time.
That's your real motivation here.
Yeah, no. Absolutely. No, so the great result for Sharapova, obviously, who's still getting quite a lot of slack on the internet and probably other places as well, over the whole Maldonian suspension business. But regardless, there's some great tennis there that I think is definitely worth talking about.
Yeah, how did you feel about that? I haven't asked you that. Like, how did you just feel watching that tennis?
Excited? You know, I don't know. I really felt like this is the power of coming out and having a clear vision of what you want to do in order to beat a specific opponent and by and large executing it. You know, just
I like that.
Taking who the players were out of the equation for a minute, because, you know, frankly, you know, when it comes to Sharapova, I don't really have strong feelings particularly. Well, I mean, I like to see her play good tennis, because it's highly entertaining when she does. But yeah, that was the thing that really just stood out to me is Sharapova just came out, and this wasn't, to me, her just coming out and just playing her kind of cookie cutter standard plan A tennis. Like, she came out to me and had a very clear idea of what it is that she wanted to do, and she executed. So
I like that that's what you took away from it, and that's how you felt, instead of, you know, everyone wants to talk about her suspension and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, water under the bridge, it's done, you know. And I can't imagine that she's not going to be pretty closely scrutinized moving forward. I'm sure she'll be randomly selected for a lot of not so random drug tests. And I mean, that is what
they
it
all
is.
Are. They get tested all the time.
Yeah.
The thing that really impressed me is, you know, she's been out of competition, quote unquote, for such a long time, and
right.
to draw, you know, Halep, who's seeded number two at the tournament in the first round, and have to come in under the lights, prime time, the whole world is watching. I mean, that's just. It's a heck of a win, and it's not like she didn't have pressure. I think that was probably one of the highest pressure matches that she's ever played, easily.
Yes, and I really loved the way that she went about it. You know, one of the things, I mean, I guess if we really talk about the X's and O's of that match, you know, one thing that I really enjoyed about it was the fact that it wasn't, you know, the games were all close. Like, she wasn't holding serve easily. Halep wasn't holding serve easily. You know, this was a dogfight, and there was a lot of high-pressure moments in the match. And, you know, despite the hiccup in the second set, I mean, she's up 4-1, loses five games in a row to drop the second, but then comes out, takes control in the third, and takes care of business. You know, Sharapova really stepped up in a lot of big moments. But, again, coming back to the idea of a big part of why I think she was able to do that was she had a very clear plan. And to me, that was very obvious watching. She attacked Halep's second serve with prejudice. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. She hit so many return winners on the second serve from Halep. It was getting a little bit ridiculous there. So that was a very clear thing that she was trying to do. She spread the court very well. You know, took the ball and sent it back even wider than it came in. Really opened the court up and got Halep out of position. And you saw that in Sharapova's serving as well. Really serving a lot of wide serves and pulling Halep out off the court and getting her on the run.
Okay, so quick question, not to get too far away from this match, but do you expect Sharapova to be a smarter player when it comes to executing tactics? She's not someone who plays with a tremendous amount of spin. She's not the best mover on the tour. That title probably goes to Halep. But she definitely was spreading the court more. She was attacking second serves. She was using... What I'm going to say is more angles than I think that she often does. Do you expect this to continue, or what? I mean, what's the explanation for this?
I think that we will see a slightly more composed. I mean, one of the things I loved about watching her play last night was she came out very aggressive. You know, she was on offense at every available opportunity. But there was a little more intelligence to that offense, a little more composure to it in some ways than we've seen in the past. And I loved the way that she used the drop shot, especially off the backhand side. And to me, that was a big telling point in that it looked very clear to me that she had a plan of pushing Halep back behind the baseline and then dropping the ball short and catching her off guard. I would say that Sharapova should probably seriously rethink ever hitting a forehand drop shot again, because I don't think I saw her hit any good ones in that match. She hit a couple of genuinely horrendous forehand drop shots, but the backhand was very effective. Even when she didn't hit it beautifully, she was able to catch Halep so far out of position. I don't think that we're going to see massive amounts of adjustment from her from one opponent to the next as a whole, because I just don't think she has enough variety and depth in her game to be able to do that. But I do think that we can start to see perhaps some slightly more sophisticated patterns on her part as time goes on. I feel like maybe she's come back with a little bit more vision in the bigger picture. You know, a telling thing to me is, like, when we look at the match, I mean, Halep ran over 1,000 feet more than Sharapova did.
That's unreal.
Like 1,200.
Usually it's actually really close. Like with the guys, even if you get dominated, you're within 200 or 300 feet.
Yeah, no, she ran like 12. Halep ran 1,200 feet more than Sharapova did. Like 20% more on average per point, which is pretty crazy. The other big thing that I was going to say. I can't remember what it was that I was going to say now. well, that's fun.
Because it's day two of the U.S. Open.
Well, there's that. Yeah. So, the other thing, that's what it was the serve. I felt like Sharapova's serve was looking a little better than it had in the past. And, you know, for those of you who didn't catch it, Jake actually wrote an article on Sharapova's serve a little while back. And if I'm smart enough, I will put a link to the article in the notes for this
That's
episode.
Quite an if.
Right. Well, but, you know, I think that there's some improvement there. It seemed like she had a little more weight on the ball, not speed, but a little more spin on her average serve. She was reaching more of the box, which I like to see. You know, still some second serve woes. I mean, 7 double faults in 3 sets is quite a lot.
Yeah.
But still 7 aces. And it just seemed to me she was able to spread the core a little better off the serve, which, you know, I think was pretty important. So,
well, look, I got to be honest. I was watching this match from the locker room. I'm here recording from New York, so I didn't get to go through it with a fine tooth comb the way we normally would. So I'm going to have to go back and look at it again to take a good, clean look at Sharapova's serve.
I certainly didn't break the serve down per se. I'm just saying it just seemed to me like there was a little more work on it. And by the way, Sharapova hit 14 return winners.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I mean, like, for clean winners on Halep,
It seemed to me that Maria was on a mission. Now, she's always been committed to driving through the ball, and she's always been committed to pretty much swinging away. Now, for her, swinging away has a very, like, it has a lot of technique to it. It's not a wild and crazy thing.
Sure.
So she's someone who's always been very aggressive with her swing as far as her ball striking goes. But that being said, I think there's definitely a difference in the way that she approached things tactically here. I mean, she just seemed like she knew exactly what she wanted to do, and she was fully committed to just executing it. And that's, I mean, when you can hit the ball that well, if you come in with that kind of mindset, I think that's really, really tough. I mean, that's going to make her a force. And whether it's her or whether it's Halep or whether it's any of the other women that are doing that, I just like to watch that kind of tennis. It's so much more entertaining for me.
Yeah, people who come out and actually have a plan and try to execute a plan. you know, that plan doesn't necessarily deviate greatly from one match to the next. I mean, it's fun to watch for sure. There was a couple other matches that I think are worth talking about. The first being Cilic and Sandgren. A lot of people are probably very surprised to see Tanner Sandgren take a set off Marin Cilic, but I think that you probably weren't so surprised.
I was not surprised at all. I was already telling people he was going to take a set off of Andy Murray when that draw came out. And actually I was saying it was going to take more than a set. So he had some chances there to make it even closer than it was against Cilic. But, you know, he's one of these younger guys that has been just grinding his way through the challengers. And I use that word very lightly. He's developed his game really in a trial by fire sort of manner. So it's not surprising at all that he can hit with Cilic from the back. It's not surprising at all that he was able to break him several times. And it's not surprising that he was able to more or less compose himself in what was absolutely the biggest competitive situation of his career.
Yeah, so probably people haven't really seen Sandgren play a lot. I mean, there's been some media coverage lately because his results have been coming along well, and obviously the name tennis is a draw in and of itself to people in the media. But maybe you could just take a second and describe a little bit the kind of player that Sandgren is.
So he's deceptively big is the first thing that I would tell people. He's about... I want to say around 6'3". He's a good 200 pounds.
Yeah, he's a big boy.
He's like farm boy strong. Okay, that's how he comes across. You know, broad shoulders. He's like a linebacker. He really is. Mm-hmm. He's fast. He's explosive. He's got a huge first serve. He likes to basically hit two serves. He'll serve aces down the tee, and he'll spread the court out wide on either side. You know, very typical of the men's tour, serve out wide or serve huge up the middle. He can do that. Plays an aggressive kick serve most of the time for his second serve, but more or less can hit all the serves. Backhand's very solid, pretty flat shot, but he's got a big power game over there. And he can do... probably most things with the forehand. Technically, if we break it down, it's a little wristy and, you know, it has some holes in it. But if he has a little bit of time, he can pretty much put the ball wherever he wants to. Likes to play far back from the baseline and basically hit the cover off the ball and run around all day until you just give up.
Right, which made him, in a lot of ways, a decent matchup for Cilic. Because, I mean, you know, one of the things I thought was very interesting when we look at the stats for that match is he actually had a higher second serve win percentage at 54% than Cilic did, Cilic at 47. And oftentimes that second serve win percentage is an indicator of who's winning the baseline rallies.
Exactly, because that's when the points are getting played out kind of from the middle of the court.
Right. And yeah, much more of the points are starting neutral rather than, you know, guys setting a first ball up with a first serve. The other thing I think that was really very telling about the match and probably the point of differentiation was how willing Cilic was to come forward. Came into the net 47 times in four sets and won 70% of them. And so that obviously was a very good play for him, whereas Sandgren only came in basically 21 times and won less than half at 10 points. So
that's a big, you know, that honestly is the difference in the match. If Cilic had not come forward that much, then we may be looking at a different result. And that's a big statement, but the truth is, you know, you got a guy that's as big and strong as Tanner Sandgren, and, you know, if he's feeling it, you're not going to hit through him in between the lines when he's 2 meters behind the baseline.
Right.
Like, even if you are Cilic, I mean, I don't know. Nobody comes to mind on the tour who really hits a bigger ball than Cilic. Like, he's about as aggressive and big as it gets. But to some degree, I mean, you have to be able to finish at the net. You have to be able to angle some balls off. You have to be able to take even more time away from these guys.
Right. I mean, especially against someone like Tennis, who's going to stand back and get a lot of balls back in play and hit, you know, hit a pretty heavy, deep shot. So, yeah.
So there's... you know, the one thing that I would point out to people, there was a comment that was made by Yanko Tipsarevic who said very bluntly in his press conference that I don't feel that there's any difference between the guys in the challengers and anybody out here, meaning any of the top 30 or top 25 guys in the world. Mm-hmm. Because as we know, Tipsarevich is a guy who's been top 10 in the world and currently is quote unquote struggling, right, with his ranking outside of the top 50. Mm-hmm. So he's been playing challengers for the last couple of years as he's trying to work his way back up to the top. The issue that he's pointing to is, hey, this is not the same challenger tour that it was 10 or 20 years ago. These guys are way better. And I mean, that's what we're seeing when we saw it there with Tennis Angren and Cilic. I mean, that was a match where realistically, Cilic should be steamrolling through there. Sangwin's never played on a court that big. He's never played the marquee match like that. He's never played a top 10 guy as far as I know. Like, that was easily major advantage to Cilic. So
right. In a sense, it had no business being that close, but at the same time, exactly, that would have been true 10 years ago. But because the challenger circuit has so much more depth now, that it's not so shocking to see some of these guys coming in that are ranked, you know, in that range and being able to be really competitive with the top guys. I mean, we look at Tiafoe's took the first set off of Federer in the match that's going on right now. I mean, Fed's leveled it up at a set apiece. But, you know, yeah. I mean, look, if you'd looked at this match at the start of the year and somebody had said Tiafoe was going to take a set off Fed after he'd won two slams already in the year, people are probably going to laugh at that. But the reality is that the gap's not as big. I'm not saying there's no gap, but, you know, the gap's not as big as people think.
Yeah, it's not that big, and it's just those tiny differences that make all the difference in the world. Yeah. So there was another match that we wanted to talk about on that side of the draw.
Yes, Thompson Sock. Sock fell in five sets. Not literally fell, you know, but he fell.
Well, he
fell out of the draw in a five set loss to Thompson.
So this is another guy who I think is ranked outside of 100 right now, but he's been up around 60 or 70. And Thompson's had a couple of big wins this year. He outgrinded David Ferrer earlier in the year and really shocked people.
Right. I remember you actually mentioning that in a podcast we did near the start of the year after that happened.
I did because I saw Thompson in the locker room beforehand and I told him, hey, you're going to outgrind David Ferrer today and that's going to be a lot of fun. And he looked at me like I was absolutely out of my mind. And I just smiled and said, look, I'm just calling it the way I see it. I don't know what to tell you. Like, the guy is as fast as a rabbit. He's got incredible balance. He can absorb power, and he can dish enough of it to hurt you. So
right.
He had a crazy up-and-down match with Sock, where Sock was up a couple of breaks, a couple of different sets, and wasn't able to close it out and wasn't able to get the job done.
Yeah, so Thompson's currently 73 in the singles, by the way. But so talk a little bit about that matchup. And, you know, so Jordan obviously can put a lot of balls in the court.
Yeah, well, Jordan can put a lot of balls in the court, but I think we should start with Sock. Sock's got a huge serve, if that's not clear to you. He does. It's a huge serve. He serves very, very well.
Second is so heavy.
Everything he hits really is heavy even. But, he wins a lot of free points on a serve. He's capable of hitting plenty of aces. And he hits a serve out wide on the deuce side that is really one of the best in tennis. I mean, it's not just like most of the guys will hit out wide and they'll take you off the court and they'll hit it maybe 95 with spin, try and get it out of your strike zone. Sock is hitting it out there like with so much spin and so much velocity that you have to change your return position just to account for that. And what that does is it means he's just at a huge advantage to win the first point, or really any deuce point in every service game. It makes it really tough to break him. Mm. He pretty much has to not hit that serve in order for you to really have a sniff at his games. Because following up on that, his forehand is basically like a right-handed Rafa who's a whole lot more aggressive.
Yeah, I was going to say the aggression thing is huge. I mean, he comes through that thing.
He goes for it, man. I mean, he hits it, you know, he would say that he hits it heavier than Rafa. We have some data on him hitting it heavier at times, but he's just much more aggressive with it in matches where Rafa is using it more to kind of move people around.
Right.
Jack is trying to hit his forehand through his opponent.
Right, and part of the reason that he does that is because his backhand leaves a little to be desired.
I think that he has, I hate to say this to a fellow American, but I think he's got one of the worst backhands in the top 100, if not. I mean, it might be the worst. I'm not sure. I haven't gone through and made a list of that. But
well, Andy Roddick has retired, so.
No, his I got to give credit. Andy worked on his backhand.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, he put a lot of hours into it. And certainly by the end of his career, it was, I mean, it was way, way better than what Jack's is. If Jack had Andy Roddick's backhand, he would probably be top five in the world. His backhand is really, really struggles with it. I mean, he goes through patches where he barely makes a return for games at a time. Like it's really tough. His approach angle on the ball is almost vertical. It's brutal.
Yeah.
It's really brutal. That could be a podcast in itself. The crazy thing is, you know, his eye hand coordination is really good, and you know, every now and then he's able to really, really smack a backhand, and that's the difference between him and say someone like Roddick. Roddick's backhand, he just didn't hurt you with, like David Ferrer, another guy. He doesn't really hurt you with his backhand, but it's gotten much better over the years.
Right.
But Sock can hurt you with it. The problem is it's proved itself very unreliable. It's sure. More like Steve Johnson. You know, he's got a, like, Sock has a good slice. Him and Stevie both have a very good slice, and they both don't do a great job hitting over their two-hander.
Right. So when it comes to the matchup, really, what we're looking at here is Sock coming out and driving play, being very aggressive, and Thompson, who isn't just consistent, he does a really good job of getting the ball where it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, Thompson is pretty much trying to put every ball into the backhand corner deep on Sock, and he just wants to do that probably 500 times.
Right. And he did I mean, they both came in a fair amount. Thompson came in 46 times over the five sets, and Sock was in 40 times. But Thompson was a lot more effective at the net, which, you know, maybe for some people might be. I mean, Sock actually is a nails doubles player, funnily enough.
It's so hard to volley against his forehand.
Right. I mean, I mean, I think, like, from an ELO standpoint, he's rated one of the strongest doubles players in the world, regardless of his ranking.
Can you give like a 10-second primer on the ELO ranking there?
Oh, yeah. So if we look at ignoring the actual ranking points, which obviously you have to go out and you know, play matches to win points. Like ELO's, you know, for people who follow chess at all and for people who don't, like, essentially it's a rating based off of your opponents, like the people that you've beaten, the people that you've lost to, etc. Right. And Jack Sock just does not lose very many doubles matches ever.
It's what's the true, it's like, what's the strength of your level as opposed to what's the number next to your game?
Yeah, what's your ranking right in this moment? Yeah. Yeah, I so mean, his doubles is kind of absurd.
To put this in perspective, if you're, say, you know, you play locally and you're a strong 4-5 male or a 5-0 male, even I would say your average 5-0 male comes to the net, he's not even going to be able to volley against Jack Sock. Okay.
Oh yeah. No,
and a 5-0 player, let's keep in mind, a 5-0 player is a darn good tennis player. I mean, that's like a guy who probably played college tennis. He's not even getting balls back when Sock's hitting forehands. I mean, it's next level.
I mean, he could hit forehands basically straight, not at you, but just straight to you. And people would struggle so hard to control the ball. It's so heavy.
Just valley balls. I mean, I watch him hit through pros just in practice where they just can't even handle his ball. So so he can hurt you. And the thing that's really impressive about this match from Thompson is that generally if Jack Sock is playing someone who's quote-unquote grinding, as in getting a lot of balls back, everybody knows his backhand's the weakness. He knows his backhand's the weakness. I mean, it's not like Jack Sock doesn't understand tennis, right? So we all know what we're trying to do, but it's just like so difficult to actually get the ball over there without Sock running around it and just slapping forehands and beating the snot out of you.
Demolishing forehands, yeah. That's really, you know, there's been a lot of players, if we look back, you know, like Carlos Moyo would be somebody who comes to mind. You know, Andy Roddick when he was playing earlier in his career, these guys are with, you know, good serves and huge forehands. And, you know, they're really dictating play with that one or two shots. and trying to cover up a weakness very strongly. And Suk does a great job of that. But, you know, in this case, Thompson was just able to weather the storm and keep making him hit the weakness and keep working on him. And eventually, you know, the interesting thing, too, is that, and this doesn't happen very often, but Thompson actually won 165 points in the course of the match to Jack Suk's 170. That's not a common occurrence. Like, typically, almost exclusively, the player that wins the most points wins the matches.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway,
I mean, okay, look, that was a really interesting match. What's next for us?
Well, let's talk about a couple of the matches. I don't think it's worth touching. We kind of touched briefly on a lot of the first round matches on Sunday. And, you know, I think talking afterwards, we both decided we'd be better off focusing a little bit on just a couple interesting matches.
I do kind of wish that we had more time and we could just go through every one of these, because there's so many things that are interesting that we could dissect about it.
Right,
but
then it would be a 6-hour long podcast. What we've done is we're just going to, you know, the top half of the draw is going to finish up tomorrow, weather permitting. We're just going to focus on a couple of the interesting matches that we would like to talk about that are in the men's second round from the bottom half of the draw, because we haven't talked about those at all yet. And I would to start talking about Tsonga and Shapovalov.
Of course you would. You steal, like, the most interesting one.
Well, I don't know about the most interesting, but I think it's interesting.
So if you haven't followed it, Shapovalov is a young Canadian. I believe he's 18 years old still. Did he just turn 19, maybe? I'm not sure if I missed his birthday. But in any case, he's very young. He's left-handed. He's got a one-handed backhand. And he just had a magical run to the semifinals of a Masters event.
Mm-hmm.
Beat Rafa there. He's ranked inside the top 70, but because of when he had that magical run and because of when the cutoff date for registration for the U.S. Open is, he was in the qualifying tournament.
Right, so he had to win 3 matches in qualifying just to make the main draw. And look, for a lot of guys, a lot of people, just even being in that situation would be really frustrating and upsetting. I mean, here you are, ranked highly enough to go straight into the main draw of the U.S. Open, but because of the date at which you got that ranking, you have to go out and beat 3 very good players just to get a crack.
Yeah, and it's a huge difference, and it's a lot of pressure. He's become the biggest story in Canada right now. They've just started holding press conferences for him and whatnot because there's so much going on that, you know, he's not used to. He's such a young guy, right? So it's been really impressive from an objective perspective to look at a young man this age to come through qualifying, win all the matches that he quote unquote was supposed to win, even though he had tough matches. There were people that he's lost to over the last 12 months.
He's come a long way in a year.
Yeah, right? He's improving quickly. And then to win his first round comfortably over Medvedev, who's another next-gen player, straight set 7-5, 6-1, 6-2. Now he's up against Tsonga in the second round. What do we really expect here? We know that he's got the potential to beat top players. He's just done it recently. But is he really going to win this match?
That's a good question. You know, one of the things I think that really changes dynamic is the fact that it is best of 5. It's a lot easier for an 18-year-old, and he's still 18, by the way. I just checked his birthday. It's in April. It's a lot easier for an 18-year-old to go out in Montreal and take down Rafa in a best of 3 sets match than it is to step out at the U.S. Open and take down, you know, anybody in the top 10 over best of 5. Shapovalov is a very aggressive player. He's very flashy and showy. And I don't mean that in a Gael Monfils, I'm going to hit tweeners for no reason kind of flashy and showy. Just that he's not afraid to be creative when it comes to, you know, making stuff happen. And he's not shy about hitting the ball. He takes a full cut at everything. And, you know, we talked a little bit after his run in Montreal about his ability to step up to the next level and become a top 30, top 20, top 10 guy is largely going to come down to his ability to manage his risk. Because, you know, that's one of the things that separates the top players. Isn't so much the shot-making ability a lot of the times as it is. I mean, if we take a guy like Gael Monfils, like, why is that guy not a multiple-time Grand Slam winner? Is because he has, you know, he plays with the tennis IQ of somebody with a very low tennis IQ. Let's just say it like that. And, you know, the end result is he's out there playing with very – his margins on the way he puts points together are very poor. Still talking about Monfils, by the way.
Look, can I – oh, you're talking about Monfils.
Yeah, still talking about Monfils. No. And so, you know, when we look at both of these guys, really, I mean, Tsonga kind of reminds me a little bit of Monfils in that he's also a little bit of a showman, not in the same sense. He's not, like, gratuitously showy or flashy, but he also is a guy who hasn't traditionally done a great job of risk management. You know, he has a very aggressive style. You know, big serve, nice serve, you know, big forehand, very, very athletic, explosive guy, can volley quite well, but just doesn't really put the patterns together super great. And that's, you know, that's why he's been kind of hovering around the 8 to 15 for most of his, you know, I say his career, but like since he really came on the scene strongly, instead of being a top 5 player. I mean, there's a lot of guys that could be in the top 5, you know, be in that 4, 5, 6 range. And stay there, like for, you know, I mean, look at David Ferrer, he was number 4 for so long, and the reason he was able to do that is in large part because he did such a great job of managing his risk, despite not having some of the tools that somebody like Tsonga has. So this is an interesting match because we've got two guys, neither of whom are great risk managers, but I think Tsonga's obviously got experience on his side. He's learned to moderate his risk to a pretty good degree. I mean, you know, he's been consistently a top 20 guy for a long time now, whereas Shapovalov's still on his way up. We don't even know where he's going to cap out right now. Obviously, we know he has the ball striking talent. So when I look at this match, I mean, I feel like Tsonga's got to be the favorite, but not a huge favorite. And I just want to say, like, people who talk about the outcome of matches like it's a certainty, you know, you can't do that. Like, you just cannot do that.
That's pretty rare. No. You have to have a really clear matchup advantage. I mean,
right.
That doesn't
And even happen. Then, like, you know, the reality is people have to go out and play. You never know what's going to happen. So much of tennis and high-level tennis is about patterns and execution. And, you know, what we can do is talk about what we can expect to happen and, you know, what's likely to happen. And then there's going to be the actual match that gets played.
Right.
And so when I look at this match, I think the fact that Shapovalov's left-handed is going to have a big impact at the end of the day.
It seems to me like that's going to really make it tougher on Tsonga.
It is. I think if it weren't for that, I would feel very comfortable picking Tsonga to win. The fact that Shapovalov's a lefty and the way that Shapovalov's game is built, to me, really makes this a dangerous match for Tsonga. Because, look, Shapovalov has a great one-handed backhand that he's very aggressive with. And Tsonga's biggest weapon is his forehand. And, you know, we've got a situation now where Tsonga's going to, if he's taking his forehand cross-court, he's going to take it to Shapovalov's backhand. Shapovalov will hurt you off that side. He's not going to win every point. He's not going to play error-free. But he's going to make his presence felt. He's going to hurt Tsonga, and he's going to be able to take control of points away from Tsonga with one swipe of the racket. Right? I mean, Tsonga can put one forehand in cross-court, and Shapovalov has the ability to smack the ever-living daylights out of a backhand and shift the momentum of a point and really take things out of Tsonga's hands to a degree. And that's a bad dynamic for Tsonga, ultimately.
Yeah.
Because Tsonga doesn't want to go out and play defensive tennis. That's not where his heart is. That's not where his brain works best. Right.
Okay, so here's my question to you. I'm gonna make my prediction right here. Are you ready?
Okay. I'm ready.
Is Tsonga going to come into the net 50 times? 5 sets. Will he make it up there 50 times?
Okay. If they go 5 sets, he will. I would expect that he's going to come into the net about 10 to 12 times per set.
What if it's 4 sets? Is he going
to
make it 50?
No, I think he's going to make it in between, you know, somewhere in the 40 to 48 range.
I think if he makes it 50 times, he wins the match.
Right. And I think not wrong about that.
I think if he stays back and lets this kid hit, I think that Shapovalov is actually going to win this one. Now, the caveat to that is he did come through qualifying. He did already have to win his next round. So he's 4 matches in a row now. If you look over what he's done over the last 5 or 6 weeks, he's played a lot of tennis. He's still very young, and his body's not really strong enough to maintain this level. I think he's gonna. I think he's gonna run out of gas.
Yeah, so it's a question. I think he will too. It's just a question of when. Like, is he gonna run out of gas, you know, tomorrow, or is it gonna be, you know, two or three matches down the line?
Well, to me, I think it's either gonna be in the fourth set, or I think it's gonna be in the next round. So, you know, if he does beat Tsonga, people are gonna be going crazy, and they're gonna be picking Shapovalov to like make it to the semifinals of this Open or something, and I don't see that happening. I don't see how his body's going to be able to hold up. I would be concerned for him if he was to keep winning too much longer. I would be concerned that he would actually hurt himself as right. far as injury. That's the concern. Not for like his mental state or something.
Yeah, sure, sure. You know, and I think one thing that we have to talk about too that's important here is Tsonga's form. You know, so he lost to Sam Querrey at Wimbledon, which, I mean, no shame in that with the tournament that Querrey had this year. But then he followed right. up with a you know, for him, a first round loss to Querrey in Montreal, followed that with a first round loss to Karlovic in Cincinnati. Both those were round of 32 matches because he had byes, which didn't, really, I think, really do him any favors. Yeah. But you know, Tsonga's, you know, lost three matches in a row coming into the U.S. Open. You know,
I think that's an advantage for him, though.
You're going to have to explain that one.
Okay, so these are the French that we're talking about. And the biggest enemy that they really have is their own motivation, right? So, like, remember what we were talking about with Sharapova, that she was on a mission and had a plan. And she had a mental representation of exactly how she wanted to play. And she was absolutely committed to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
If Tsonga plays like that, then it's like magic. All of a sudden, his margins are better. His discipline is there. I mean, he reminds me a bit of old school Andre Agassi. If his motivation is really, really high, then he's a monster. He's so tough to play. And, you know, he can fight out five-set matches and he can play great, great tennis. And so I think that he's going to come in hungry. He's lost three first rounds and, well, he's lost basically three in a row coming into this. He beat Koppel in the first, who has been playing really good ball, and Tsonga dispatched him handily. And Koppel's yeah. got the kind of big game that can give him some trouble
right.
that he doesn't necessarily like.
Right, and I think one important thing that's going to make a huge difference to Tsonga is how well he serves, right? And in the match against Koppel, I mean, he hit 13 aces, was putting 66% of first serves in, and here's the kicker. He won 94% of his first serve match, first serve points over the first three sets.
That's outrageous. That is
a bit outrageous.
And that's why I say, look, if you look at the score line against Koppel, it's 3-3 and 4. It's not like Koppel wasn't in the match. But when you're winning, I mean, the guy barely lost a point on first serve. I mean, that's dispatching someone. Like, he was never threatened.
Right.
So that's what I mean when I say that I think it's going to work to his advantage. I think it's a little bit weird. I think that has a lot to do with Tsonga in particular, his psychology, and to some degree the French culture that is on the tour right now, because that's not a permanent thing. That's a generational thing to me, that there's a few guys like Monfils is like that as well. Like, if Monfils goes 10 matches and he's only won one or two matches, like, you need to look out because he's about to make the finals.
Yeah, I would have, if it weren't for such an emphatic performance from Tsonga in his first round match, I would have wondered if that was going to be his reaction, right? But, you know, it seems as though that is his reaction. He came out and made a statement in that opening round, and you know, I mean, a lot of people, and again, coming back to what we were saying earlier about the depth of tennis at the moment, a lot of people probably look at that and they say, so he beat Koppel, like, first of all, who is that? And second of all, why would this be a big deal? Because Koppel's like 87 in the world, so he must suck at tennis, right? I'm being sarcastic, but I mean, people actually talk this way.
And
you know, it's important to realize, like, if you're 87 in the world, like, you're really stinking good at tennis.
Yeah, it's not just that. I mean, the only reason that a guy like Marius Koppel isn't ranked a lot higher is because of a couple of small decisions in a match. I mean, if you went out there and watched him hit balls, you'd be thinking, okay, which top 10 player is this? I mean, he clubs the ball, and he's solid and consistent, and he'll hit 100 balls in a row without missing in practice. It doesn't, you know, he'll do whatever you ask him to do. But when you put him out there against another guy who's at that level, it becomes more of a chess match, right?
Right, just those little things that we were talking about, the little patterns, the small stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that one's going to be fascinating. There's one more, right? If we scroll down.
Well, you get to pick. I picked one. You can pick one.
Yeah. So the one that I really want to talk about, even though I don't have that much to say about it, that's ironic, is Lucas Pouillet versus Gerald Donaldson.
Why don't you want to talk about it? Why don't you have much to say about it?
Well, because I think it's just a quick point. To me, I mean, Pouillet is a top 20 player. He's one of the best guys from the ground on the tour. He's seeded 16 here. We know there's a few guys that are missing. He's shown that he can hang with some of the best. You know, he's shown that he's hanging right there with the top 10 guys, and he's tabbed like him and Dominic Thiem as guys that are, you know, potentially big four guys down the road when the big four we have right now retire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Donaldson is a young American. I want to say 21 years old. I could be wrong on that. He might still be 20. But he's the best returner out of all the Americans. And from the ground, he's very, very steady and plays a very big game. And to me, I want to watch this match and I want to see how close this one really is. I mean, if Donaldson gets blown out 1-1 and 1, then I won't have much to say. But there's a very good chance that Donaldson can win it. And even better, I think there's just a very, very good chance that it's just going to be a really, really tight 4 or 5 set match, which would tell me that this upcoming generation is a lot, lot better than what people are talking about.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's going to be interesting for, look, people, if you like backhands, you need to tune into this match if you can find it somewhere. Because these guys both have amazingly good backhands. Donaldson just doesn't miss. Like, he just does not miss on that side. You cannot break him down. You go low. Like, there's just not a whole lot you can do to force errors on that side.
That's right. And let's be clear, this isn't like when Michael Chang didn't miss. I mean, he is clubbing the ball.
Yeah,
like,
this is a different animal.
This is, I mean, I wish I could hit a forehand that good, because I can't.
I think a lot of guys wish they could hit forehand. I mean, I know for sure Ben Pair wishes he could hit a forehand that well.
That's too far. That's not
was, that too, was that too
he,
far? Was that
he can far? As long as the match doesn't depend on it. So, yeah. Look, no, but I mean, seriously. Like, you may not get the impression from TV, but, I mean, if you watch this guy's average backhand is, like, as good as I can hit a forehand when I'm just going full power. I mean,
yeah, his backhand
it's very,
is,
very good.
Is, yeah, it's very, very good. But then, you know, if we look across the other side of the net, the other dude's backhand isn't too shabby either.
I mean, Pouillet's.
Yeah, Pouillet's, I mean, his backhand is beautiful. It is a thing of beauty. I'm a big fan of it, in case I didn't make that clear. So
there's going to be long points here. This is not like a serve and volley.
The ball is going to get hit very hard and very well many times. Let's just put it like that. And I think I think it's going to be a close match. It's going to be well fought. You know, I would put the edge to Pouillet. He just moves better. And I think that's going to be the deciding factor. And I think his forehand is technically a little stronger than Donaldson's is. And, you know, between the movement and the forehand, I think that's going to be enough. That he's going to come away with that one, but I think it will be 3 or 4 very tight sets. So
this is going to be my last comment of the night for the podcast, and it's going to get really specific. I'm going to be looking for Donaldson to break when the balls get old.
Right, which isn't very long, folks, because
that's after 7 or 8 games, because they get changed out every 9 games.
Right.
And they use a lot of balls. They've got like 4, I think, cans of balls at all times on that court. So, but I mean, this is how much I think that they're going to be hitting the cover off the ball. That when those balls are old over the last 2 service games, I think that there's a chance that Pouillet is going to have a hard time serving it out against Donaldson. I mean, I think they're going to be hitting it that big. So this one's going to be fascinating for me. It's going to be a lot of fun. As long as I'm not coaching another match, then I'm going to be sitting planted in front of it.
Fair enough. All right, folks, I think that's about it from us for tonight. We're going to try and get another podcast out in a couple of days once we get more results in and more fun stuff to talk about. But, you know, if you have any comments or questions or concerns, I mean, we'll take concerns too, won't we, Jake?
Concerns are good. If there's anything that happened that you missed or want us to talk about, then there's obviously more than enough matches at the U.S. Open. So hit us up. You can email me, jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And I am glenn@tacticaltennis.com. And if
is that one N or two N's,
Glenn? That's with one N, Jacob. Is Jacob with one B or two B's?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Wow. All right, then. Yeah, but also, folks, if you haven't already, share with your friends. You know, we'd love to get more listeners. And outside of that, have a great day.
Good night, guys.